For KOSU News, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. Well, on Monday, the Oklahoma City School Board unanimously approved the superintendent's Pathway to Greatness, which closes 15 schools and reconfigures or relocates 17 others. The plan includes changes to school boundaries, grade structures, and feeder patterns, meaning thousands of students will attend a different school beginning in August. Ryan, what do you think of this move by the state's largest school district?
It's one of the largest moves in the state's, in the school district's history and then education's history in the state of Oklahoma. It will redefine the way Oklahoma City public schools look. I think that there are a lot of open-ended questions here about what the repurposed buildings are going to look like. I think that a lot of the concern right now is around what this does to neighborhoods. Many of the schools that are being closed are neighborhood schools, and they've become anchors in those neighborhoods that are really important for that community. And so whenever you get rid of them, the school district's saying they're going to repurpose them. What does that ultimately look like? But at the end of the day here, what we're going to see is hopefully more uniform delivery of services to students across the state or across the Oklahoma City public schools, so that we've got students that are getting art instruction, you know, getting, you know, better access to counselors, to everything else that everybody has in these school districts and not just isolated in certain pockets.
Yeah, and even this is 60,000, it was built for 60,000 students, now only has 46,000 students. So really, it's kind of doing what it needs to do, which is to consolidate.
Absolutely, and I think Ryan is right. I mean, this has been something that has been coming for quite a while. I mean, and clearly the process has been very thoughtful, very strategic. I think the fact that the school board was unanimous in its vote said that they had done the best possible job at this moment in time of launching a new, really a new era in how they want to move forward providing the best possible education for all of the schools, and as one of the board members said, regardless of their zip code. So I think it's not about savings and the money side, because in a $600 million annual budget, I mean, they're only talking $4 million savings, and the savings really is being redirected into what Ryan talked about in terms of adding art, music, physical education. I mean, counselors, nurses. I mean, a lot of folks that have to be in this equation. That, you know, when you really look at the numbers, the bond issue will alleviate some of the bond money will alleviate some of the need for the $11 million or whatever it's going to take to kind of move these schools around, mm-hmm. get them set for an August 12th school opening. So, you know, I think the long and the short of it is everyone, you know, I think steps into this trying to be very optimistic and knowing that something had to take place, that it was going to be painful. Not everyone was going to be happy, but at the end of the day, they got the best result they could.
Ryan, I'm a little torn about this because the two elementary schools I went to, Linwood Elementary and Horace Mann Elementary, are two of the schools that are going to be closed. What do you tell these neighborhoods, these people that basically are losing their schools?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what to tell them. I mean, I think that if you've been through a community that's lost a school in the past, every community that's been through that, small or large, knows how difficult that is. We're going through 15 closures right now, all at once. And so these schools, you know, I know, you know, the elementary school that my son goes to, that my daughter will go to next year, it's a cornerstone of our neighborhood. You know, Cleveland Elementary, you know, fortunately one of the schools, at least fortunately for us, right, one of the schools that's not on the closure list. It's part of that neighborhood. It's part of the community. The community's named after that school. Right. And so, you know, every one of the, whether it's, you know, Gatewood or Edgemere, any of these neighborhood schools, even if they've had low attendance rates, a lot of this has been as important as the schools are to the neighborhoods. They just haven't been functioning the way that they ought to have been. And, you know, you had low enrollment rates, low performance rates. You know, it's hard to keep teachers in some of these schools. You've had a lot of neighborhoods where people have moved their students out to private schools or have relocated them to other school districts. So, you know, this has been coming for a long time. It's not going to be easy, but it may very well be the only solution that the district has right now.
And I think that's right. When you're operating at 60% capacity, I mean, that doesn't provide for the right the right atmosphere, the right resources, everything to be in place to really provide the kind of education that every Oklahoma City student deserves. But now repurposing, kind of realigning these schools and making these changes, that's going to move it up to 84%. 4% was the number that they said in terms of capacity. That makes it a much better process across the board, and we'll just have to wait and see. I'm sure there are going to be some more adjustments as they get into the next school year that they're going to have have to come back and recommend to keep this moving forward.
And hopefully as we learn more about how these buildings are going to be repurposed, it could be something where the neighborhood still has a functioning operating core at their community center.
Republican lawmakers plan to fast-track bills giving more power to the governor over five agencies, the Departments of Corrections, Transportation, Mental Health, as well as the Oklahoma Health Care Authority and Office of Juvenile Affairs. Five measures moving quickly through the legislature give the governor power to hire and fire agency heads and appointing most of the boards and commissions. Neva, Governor Stitt seems supportive of this measure.
Absolutely. This is something the governor said from the outset he wanted. I think what we have seen in this early part of the legislative session is that there was a lot of very intense negotiating back and forth between the House, Senate, and the governor to come up with a deal that they all could live with. Unfortunately, it became a partisan vote, which I think even the governor, by some of his comments, clearly was frustrated by, hoping that this would be something that would be viewed. It's about all Oklahomans, about making government more transparent, more efficient, and I think that the notion that somehow that you're going to trade experienced professionals as these agency directors for political appointees by the governor, as some of the Democrats suggested, is just bogus. And I think that the give and take of the checks and balances that they came up with in terms of the governor being able to make the selection of the agency head, but that they still would keep the governing boards while the governor gets five of those appointees and the House gets two and the Senate gets two, still there is the opportunity to have a board in place. What was injected into the board process was the ability to be able to remove board members, and that included the House and Senate being able to remove an agency director, executive director, by a two-thirds vote in both chambers. So there was a lot of give and take, a lot of negotiating, but at the end of the process, the governor got what he wanted, and I think it is clearly a seismic change in terms of how government is going to function in the future in Oklahoma.
Right. Ryan, yes.
Well, yeah, I don't think that it's fair to cast the criticisms from folks like Emily Virgin, the Democratic leader in the House, or Senator Julia Kurt in the Senate as partisan. And, I mean, they happen to be Democrats, but what they're raising are very legitimate concerns here. Whether the concerns are we're going to have political hacks that are going to be placed in these positions, and I think that that's, I think that's one of the more spurious arguments, but I think it will politicize the process. And that's what Representative Virgin and Senator Kurt and others have been concerned about, is that we politicize this process in a way that instead of having boards hiring folks that the governor has put forward, these are essentially going to be political picks. And now they're not only political picks in the sense that the governor has a say in if they're hired, now the legislature has a say in whether or not they stay there. So in the event that right now we have a pretty unified government right now, at least from the Republican standpoint, Republican control in the House and the Senate and the Republican governor, if you end up in a situation where that's not the case, whether it's Republican infighting or Republicans and Democrats at some point controlling different branches of government, we could end up in a really interesting situation for an agency head of who do they answer to? Who's their boss? Do they answer? I mean, I guess we can say they answer to the people of Oklahoma, but do they answer to the governor or do they answer to two-thirds of the legislature? The other part of this that I think is, you heard it here last week, folks, because we said that the boards were probably going to stay. We weren't going to see a plan that didn't have boards, but the board now is at will. And so if you're a board member and you want to be a contrarian on that board, which that's an important role for some people to play, is to be a contrarian, you might not be long for that board. So I think that we're going to take a lot of transparency where you have Open Meetings Act that apply right now. They may not apply to some of these meetings. We may have folks that can't feel like they can say everything that they want. And we're confusing accountability and transparency with the consolidation of power.
Lawmakers pass legislation rejected by voters in November. The Senate Business, Commerce, and Tourism Committee passed SB 902 to allow eye doctors in big box stores like Walmart. Ryan, is this going against the will of the voters?
You know, I think that at first blush it could appear that way. And the lobby for the Oklahoma Optometry and Ophthalmology Association, they're doing a great job of casting that as going against the will of the voters. But if you'll go back and listen to some past episodes of This Week in Oklahoma Politics, you'll hear Neva and I talk about one of the real concerns with that state question was not the substance of what it did, allowing optometrists to operate in big box retailers, but where it was going to be placed in the state constitution versus in a state statute, so that if the lawmakers needed to at some point come back and modify that because it was something was working or wasn't working, or they wanted to improve it or do away with a part of it, that's really difficult if it's in the state constitution. And I think that a lot of concerns on both sides of the aisle with that state question, where the fact that it amended the constitution and not statute. This amends statute, so that's a very different, we're talking about a very different animal. Now, the substance of whether or not you think this should happen or not, yeah, that's still a real political question that people get to decide, but it should be out there at front and center that this is not the same thing that voters looked at back in November.
Neva?
I think it's not the same thing, but it is a continuation of something that has been trying to go through the legislative process for several years. Then they went the direction of a vote of the people. That didn't pass. And so I think what we're seeing now is back to the legislature and this give and take of trying to fine-tune a bill that they can get enough support to actually get it passed. And Ryan is right. We talked about this many times.
Yeah.
In the past, and one of the things that I remember saying was the fact that if it didn't pass, that in all likelihood they would come back to the legislature and start through this process again, and that's where we are. So they've gotten it out of committee. They have alleviated some concerns by saying that that there's basically a phase in on the number of stores that can open optometry practices each year. That it has to be an independent optometrist to open, like in one of the big box stores. So they're trying from the side of the kind of the Walmart side, the big box store side, they are trying to come up with something that will be amenable to a majority of the lawmakers if they can get it passed and alleviate this notion that it's really kind of flying against the will of the people who have already spoken on this issue. So it's going to be fascinating to see how this kind of continues to move through the process. And I don't think anybody would be quick to handicap it and say it's a foregone conclusion which right. direction it's going
and,
to go.
And opponents have said that this the optometrists usually say that, you know, the problem is it's going to reduce quality of care, mm-hmm. because you'll basically have eye doctors, even if it's a private organization, inside of a Walmart rather than at your actual eye doctor.
Well, and the scope of practice issues are one of the perennial issues that happen at the Capitol. They often fly under the radar. You know, it used to be ophthalmologist and optometrist versus each other, and now it's optometrist versus Walmart or independent optometrist versus Walmart. And so, you know, who can do what, where they can do it. These are issues that the legislature wrestles with every year, sure. on a number of different issues. You know, I think that lawmakers would be wise to look at that. I will say this, that as much as I believe this is a different piece of legislation, then it's unfair to say that the voters rejected this. In all honesty, I doubt that as much as I hope that Neva and I are influencing the way that people think about not how to think or not what to think, but how to think about politics in Oklahoma. I doubt that there were very many voters that went to the polls and said, I'm for this or against this on the basis that it's in the Constitution versus statute. So lawmakers, if they vote for this, are going to have a hard time going back to their constituency and answering and saying, well, this is different. I mean, that's a, you know, threading that needle could be hard back home.
And I think it'll be interesting. I mean, there are some, even among the Optometric Association, that are saying that they've been told, whether this is hearsay or not, that Walmart is basically taking the position that if they are unable to come up with an agreement during this legislative session, that they will go back in 2020 to the people and have another state question on the ballot. So I think there's a real hard charge on both sides on this issue, and that's what makes these types of issues so fascinating, because they really do engage all parts of not only the legislative process, but Oklahomans. I mean, rural, metropolitan. I mean, from every side of the debate, you see all of these ideas infused into the discussion. It's interesting. It hasn't really risen to the point, it doesn't appear, that the public has really gotten fully engaged in it. And I think that's where it will become more fascinating, if they try this attempt at a lot of paid efforts to mobilize just rank and file voters out there to get engaged with their lawmakers.
Ryan, you're right. These kind of bills go through all over the place, and I'm sure if this had passed two or three years ago when it first came up, I don't think any Oklahoman would have even noticed. They would have gone, oh, look, there's an eye doctor in my Walmart, where obviously the lobbyists for the eye doctors are fighting against it. But it wouldn't have gotten the public eye unless you had put this. So actually, the whole fact that it went to a vote of the people is now why the public notices.
Yeah, and I think that, strategically, would Walmart have been in a better position if they'd kept going back to the legislature? If they're doing what Neva is saying, what they're saying is that we have an endless well of money to put into ballot measures from now until the next 10 years to make this happen. The other context that this is happening in that I think is important, I don't know how it figures into the, or factors into the political outcome of this, but we are watching the way the healthcare delivery systems are changing in the United States right now, right here in Oklahoma. I mean, if you've gone to a CVS, you might have seen a MinuteClinic. You know, CVS is doubling down on MinuteClinic, so you're seeing more healthcare delivery and providers in retail environments, and so the novelty of that, I think, is going to go away real fast. We're going to be used to walking in and seeing buying. A pack of gum and, getting your blood pressure
or your flu shot
and everything else, right there in the same place. And so the idea that anybody would be against having an optometrist in a Walmart right now may make sense. But 10 years from now, I think it's going to be a hard sell.
Well, and you have other health-related issues that are really at the forefront right now in some of these legislative discussions. The anesthesiologist nurse practitioners, mm-hmm. I mean, is a very intense back and forth engagement during this legislative session, and they are broadening kind of their outreach in terms of trying to mobilize folks through direct mail and other paid advertising to try to gin up some elevated discussion and debate on the issue. So how of these kind of merge together now that we're kind of past the first deadlines and we're really kind of getting down to the give and take of which bills are really going to make it to the finish line. I think it's going to be very interesting to watch these in particular.
In terms of scope of practice bills, no one will ever outdo the fight between veterinarians and teeth floaters.
I mean, teeth floaters.
I would agree.
So if there's a drinking game, somebody just passed out.
And it's interesting. When you have so many freshman lawmakers, when that very point has been raised, I mean, in the hallways and in discussion, many of them are absolutely unaware, don't remember, didn't follow, and have no sense of what that really was all about. And I think that factors into all of this when you have so many folks up there that are really just, they're in the throes of this first session. They're not used to this intense lobbying by all sides in a very professional, very effective manner, and it's going to be interesting to see how that factors into the equation as well.
The number of stories I had to do describing what teeth floating is.
Well, and then it became a referendum on reproductive rights. It was the most bizarre episode in my entire history at the legislature.
So in Oklahoma's senior senator says he might vote for a resolution blocking President Trump's emergency declaration to build a wall. Senator Jim Inhofe says he's concerned about the president taking money away from military construction appropriations. Neva, is Inhofe right to be concerned here?
Well, I think every senator is concerned when you start looking about the impact in your own home state. And in the instance of Oklahoma, according to published reports, $175 million in military construction projects in our state could be affected if the president is able to continue to move forward on this idea of tapping into these accounts for the border wall. So, I mean, when you have to come home and explain that, that becomes a much different proposition than just the general kind of big picture look at it from the Washington, D.C. side. So I think it's going to be interesting having passed in the House. I think there were only As I recall, maybe 13 Republicans that joined with the Democrats on that. But now, you know, on the Senate side in this vote, they need four Republicans, and they may well have them. I mean, there's a three that seem very committed to voting no, a fourth that is likely. So this really sets up for the first veto for the president potentially in his time in office. So we'll just have to see how this rolls out. But I do think, I mean, when you have senators like Senator Inhofe, who is recognized as one of the solid conservatives, who is even in an editorial in the Tulsa World basically saying that the president should listen to folks like Inhofe and George Will and others who have said that preserving the constitutional order of appropriations is more important than maintaining some campaign promise. Those are big issues that really, I think, give pause to a lot of folks in this conversation.
Ryan.
Well, I don't think that he'll be the fourth vote, but he may be the fifth or the sixth. I mean, I don't think that Senator Inhofe wants to be the deciding vote here. But once you have four, I think that he'll probably be a yes vote on the resolution that would go in front of the president's desk. I wish that the reason that he were doing this were because of the everything from the immigrant caravan, the bogus news stories about the immigration caravan that's coming to the United States, the bogus idea of the crisis on the border, that the national emergency really exists there, the ignoring of the fact that ports of entry are the places where we're really seeing human trafficking and fentanyl coming into the United States. It's not at the southern border. All of that's just manufactured political crisis. I wish that were the reason that he's against it, but as he said, it's his own backyard here. This is defense spending, defense appropriations, a lot of money for the private sector that could be at play here, a lot of money for military installations right here in Oklahoma. So however he gets to that vote, I'm glad that we've got it.
I do think that there, in all likelihood, I would expect that there's a good probability that there will only be four Republicans, that it will be the predictable Tillis, Collins, and Murkowski, with probably Rand Paul or one of the others coming in as the fourth. And when that happens, I really don't see the Jim Inhofes and some of these other folks stepping across and being a no vote, because what will be intended was accomplished. And so I don't, in light of looking at the future and reelection in 2020, I think a lot of these folks are going to step back and let this just move through the process as it is.
But what happens when he vetoes it and then it comes back to the House and Senate for a override, and maybe then that argument comes up?
And I think that becomes a different proposition. But a lot of a lot of pretty seasoned veteran political analysts on the Hill suggest that that there will not be the votes there for the override.
Yeah, I don't think so, the vote's there for the override. I think that Senator Inhofe, if he were going to vote no, he would need to vote no on the original resolution to send a message to the president: don't veto this. Go back to your emergency order. Rethink that course of action. And I think adding to the reasons that he should be against this, it's similar. We're talking about the separation of powers here in Oklahoma with these agency bills. This is a separation of powers issue. This is executive overreach. It shouldn't matter who the president is, what party they're from. It shouldn't matter what party controls the Senate or the House. This is about the integrity of the institution. And if you're going to have a real separation of powers in this country, you have to make sure that the executive abides by his constitutional prerogatives and limitations. And he's not doing that right now.
Oklahoma Muslim Day at the Capitol took place earlier this week, and for the first time in its 5 years, participants were welcomed by the governor. Governor Stitt, he made his way through the halls and welcomed the participants. The Tulsa World's Randy Crable reported there were also fewer protests yelling and calling the Muslims terrorists. Ryan, what's changed?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's changed is former State Representative John Bennett's not there to stir the pot. It gives a lot of what we've seen over the last several years, and one of the dangerous things in terms of Islamophobia that's existed in Oklahoma. It's not that it's existed, because we know that it exists, but that it's been given credibility and legitimacy by state leadership. And for the longest time, that was Representative John Bennett, who held these kangaroo court hearings in the legislature that were bigoted, that were hateful, and that spewed all sorts of ignorant misrepresentations about Muslims in Oklahoma and about Islam. And when you don't have an individual there that has that mantle of authority and power, that's out trying to encourage people to show up to counter protest, then that kind of goes away. Now, that doesn't just stop at Representative Bennett. Leadership allowed him to do that. And I think that My sense is now that leadership from the governor's office down is less tolerant of that kind of intolerance among their ranks.
Does it make a difference? Because he's a businessman. And most businessmen will tell you, you have to reach out to everybody because everybody has to buy your product. Does it help that he's a businessman and realizes that all Oklahomans are valuable regardless of...
Absolutely. And I think the one thing that he said many times on the campaign trail, he reiterated in his state of his inaugural address as well as the state of the state, and that was that he was committed to be a governor for all 4 million Oklahomans. And he's making good on that. He's making good on that promise. I think it's a sincere belief on his part that he is there to do the people's business and that it is for all the people and what is best for all the people. And I think his approach just like we've talked about, how to reshape government, how to rethink how we provide services and make sure that we're doing what government is supposed to do and do it better and more efficient and more economically, but in a broader way that serves the greater good. I think those are the things that he's all about. And he's a guy that's clearly, you know, I mean, he's not just talking the talk, he's walking the walk. I mean, this is someone who is really putting a great deal of time and energy into his first couple of months in office. I mean, this is someone who I think most observers at the Capitol would say, I mean, this is a high energy guy who is willing to be on the move, making connections, being around the people not only inside the Capitol but across the state as well. So it's very refreshing, and I think that tone and I think that demeanor that the governor is demonstrating is really spilling over into the way the business is being conducted at the Capitol. And I think ultimately it will change the culture of our agencies and the mindset of how to do their jobs better to provide what they need to for the people of Oklahoma.
So different. Governor Mary Fallon's style was to take a back seat. You know, she didn't project the power of the governor's office during her 8 years. And I think, you know, quite to her detriment, her agenda suffered
probably
as a result of that.
Her popularity also went down.
Governor Stitt has not done that at all. He has projected the power of the executive in a very open I think that authentic way. I mean, when he showed up at Muslim Day at the Capitol, it wasn't contrived. It wasn't, he didn't condition it as like, you know, he didn't have to show up and say, well, I'm with you on this, but he just showed up and it wasn't.
There was no press conference.
There was no press conference. He just walked in.
In the same way that on Monday, he had the Democratic leadership in the House and the Senate over for breakfast at the mansion and had a conversation where they could begin to know each other better and have a give and take, and those kinds of efforts on the part of the governor will pay great dividends down the road in terms of getting accomplished what he sets out as his major agenda points.
And none of this would have happened without CARE Oklahoma and Adam Saltani, their executive director, over the many years of having. This isn't the first day that they've done this, and they've kept showing up, even though many years they have had counter protesters out there yelling at them, insulting them, threatening them and their lives as they walked into that building. And so Adam Saltani and their allied organizations that have been doing this and have been persistent have led to this moment as much as Governor Stitt showing up.
Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.